Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Empowering Family Caregiver Show on Blog Talk Radio. I am Polly Whitehorn, your host for today's show, sponsored by eCareDiary.com. Today, the focus of our show is the Compassionate Guide to Caring for a Dying Loved One. I am very pleased to introduce our distinguished guest, Deborah Duda, a therapist and counselor for the terminally ill and their families for over 30 years. Deborah provides an enlightening guide to caring for a terminally ill relative or friend in the fourth edition of her acclaimed book, Coming Home, a practical and compassionate guide to caring for a dying loved one. Coming Home has been used to train hospice workers for decades. A step-by-step guide to the physical, spiritual, and emotional aspects of serving as a caregiver. Previous editions of Coming Home have been endorsed by Mother Teresa herself, as well as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, author of the groundbreaking book on death and dying. We're having a little bit of technical difficulty. I'm still waiting for Deborah to come on the line, so if you just bear with me for a few more seconds. We're just waiting for her to call in. She's calling in from Hawaii, and there seems to be a little bit of delay. We're still waiting for Deborah to join us, so please stand by. Deborah Duda will be with us shortly. We're still waiting on Deborah Duda, the author of The Compassionate Guide to Caring for a Dying Loved One. Ah, okay, Deborah. Deborah's just on the line now. Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
Great, great. I just finished up the introduction, and I've just got a ton of questions I want to ask you, and I know our audience is just so interested in what you have to say. Well, firstly, what inspired you to write this book, Coming Home?
Polly, the inspiration came a long, long time ago. I had a friend who had cancer and was dying, and her husband forbade all of her friends to talk with her about it. And I was just furious. It was like, here was the most important thing that was happening in her life at that time was her dying, and she had to do it alone. There was no outside support, and there was this a denial of what was happening. But I sort of stored that in the back of my consciousness. Then years later, I was a foreign service officer, and I was assigned to a task force in the White House to answer letters that parents who had had children who died in Vietnam wrote to President Lyndon Baines Johnson. And I was the one who had to answer these letters. And it was a very difficult job. I cried most days at work. And then again, there was a time when I didn't think about that death and dying. It didn't look like what my life was going to be dedicated to helping people make friends with death and dying. And years later, I was on what was fairly typical in the 70s, a spiritual pilgrimage to the East, sort of looking for wisdom outside of myself. And at one point, I was living in a small village in the mountains in Nepal. And it was wonderful. I recorded the sounds of village life. I loved it. Then I started having nightmares that I or someone in my family was dying. And every night it was either my dad or myself were dying. And it got so I was afraid to go to sleep for fear of, who I would dream about that night. And at one point, one of the Sherpas, those mountain guides in the Himalayas, came up the path to my village. He had a copy of Newsweek magazine, which he gave to me, and this had a photograph of Mother Teresa on the cover. So I read the magazine, looked at her photograph, and I decided, the way to get over something you're afraid of is to put yourself in the middle of it, and once it becomes something familiar and known, I won't be frightened anymore. So I set off, actually the very next day, walking, taking buses and planes across India till I got to Calcutta, I decided that I would call Mother Teresa and ask her if I could work in one of her homes for the dying. So I got to Nepal, and the hotel I was staying in was so inexpensive there weren't even phones in the room. So I went to a public phone out in the street, and I dialed 0 for operator, and I told the operator, I'd like to speak with Mother Teresa. And in 2 minutes, Mother Teresa was on the phone.
You're kidding me. What a story.
Oh, no. She was on the phone. So I told her, I said, you know, I've had this dream about you, and may I come talk with you? And she said, well, come right over, my child. So I took a rickshaw over to the Sisters of Convent Charity, her home, and we met in her little tiny, tiny office. And she was just like you see her in the photograph with the white sari with the blue edges.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat and talked, and I asked her what for me was, you know, was a crucial question at that point, was can I work in one of your homes for the dying? And her reply was, no, my child. Go home and work with the sadness and suffering around you at home. There are people around you there who are sad and suffering. So no matter what I asked her, the answer was the same. I thought, well, you know, if I adopt one of these beautiful babies from the orphanage, I'll forget about this dying stuff. And I asked her, and again she said, no, my child, there's sadness and suffering around you at home. Go home and work with that. So that's essentially what I did. I came back to the United States, worked with my own the sadness within me, and then I did a master's in psychology. And at one point, there were several friends and my father who were all dying at the same time, mm-hmm. and who I was involved with their deaths at home. And the experience was so different than anything that I had imagined. I had only was aware of hospital deaths that seemed somehow just so isolated from family and love and comfort and meaning, that these home deaths were totally inspiring and uplifting. So I decided that I would write a book about it, nobody had to reinvent the wheel. And at the time, one of my mentors also was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and Elizabeth was very encouraging, read the manuscript, was cheering me on, and her writing at the time, she had written On Death and Dying, which was sort of totally groundbreaking book about how do we make kinder the way we care for our loved ones who are dying.
Yeah.
But there was no, you know, guidebook. I'm always very interested in the nitty-gritty. Well, what do you do, you know, when you get a possible terminal diagnosis? So the book is a holistic book. It goes from, you know, the moment you get that possible diagnosis, all the way through how to care for them, all the legal aspects, the emotional aspects, medical, you know, from details of how to diagrams to how to give an injection to thoughts on how to help a dying person find meaning in their experience, all the way to when they are buried and how we celebrate their lives afterwards. So that's kind of the story of how things got going, and it's been a quite a journey since then, of founding hospices, working with people, and continuing to write.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And it seems now more than ever, seniors are and others in our other age groups too are choosing to spend their last days at home. What challenges do you think caregivers should be prepared for in this situation?
I think they have to be very clear, as the caregivers, as a family, as a group of friends, that if the dying person's wish is to remain at home, that this also works for the caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
That they then, if their decision is yes, we want to do this at home, everyone's in agreement, then make a list of, you know, what do you need. There's actually a list in my book of things to prepare for. What do you need in terms of nursing or medical support? Do you have a doctor who will support you at home? Do you have a hospice program? Is that appropriate? And if you have to enter into a hospice program, a physician has to have, as said, that that you're likely to die within the next 6 months. So people can enter a hospice program, and then if they find that they're getting well, you know, some wonderful miracle has happened, which they do happen, you can always leave the hospice program and come back later. But they're a wonderful, wonderful resource. They have everything you need in terms of the medical attention that's needed, support for the family in all kinds of ways, in grieving, in preparing for this death. And what happens is, according to the hospice statistics, people often come into hospice within their last 9 days. And it would be much more helpful for the family if they would decide earlier. But people often think, well, if I go into a hospice, that's like, you know, admitting that the death is going to happen. And what actually the statistics prove, people who are in hospice programs on average live 30 days longer than people who have not gone into hospice programs.
Hmm.
And part of that, I think, has to do with just the comfort of being at home with people you love in a familiar surrounding. You know, the things that have given immediate meaning to your life, your partner, your children, your favorite chair, the dog, the cat, your friends, makes a place for you to consider ultimate, you know, what was the meaning of my life, ultimate meaning. So these are some of the things that for people to consider, for families to consider.
Well, let me ask you something. What would you, what is a care plan for a senior dying at home?
Okay, if someone is in a hospice program, a care plan is a holistic kind of plan for how do we care for this person.
Mm-hmm.
So a hospice will have an interdisciplinary team. That means they'll have social workers, nurses, who collaborate with the patient's attending physician. And it's an individualized plan for each person.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan recognizes, you know, the family's needs, the religious needs, cultural considerations, all the aspects of what a family needs support in to make this experience of dying as meaningful and as comfortable as possible.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, it prescribes, you know, medical equipment and supplies, helps the family, you know, understand the process and to make, you know, sort of realistic and achievable goals.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, I think one main concern is about pain management and how is that handled in the home?
Okay, pain management, that's one of the things that that dying people tend to fear. And the family is, how will they manage pain at home if someone you love is in pain?
Mm-hmm.
In nearly all cases, can be handled just as well at home as it can in a hospital or clinical setting. The hospice staff, and particularly hospice physicians, are the experts in pain management. I mean, they teach other doctors how to manage pain. And doctors and nurses, an attending nurse can teach you how to give injections where that's necessary. There are now pain pumps that even the person who's the dying person can push a button, for example, in a pump, and administer pain medication to themselves when they feel that they need it.
Mm-hmm.
So they formulate very, very specific pain management programs suited to the individual person, because everyone's experience of pain, most people's experience of pain is different.
Mm-hmm.
It's very individual. So it's not something to fear. It's just something to do.
Mm-hmm. How can caregivers and seniors be prepared financially for an in-home care situation?
That's a very good question, considering our country, the financial state of affairs in our country at this time. There's really very little there. You know, a few people have long-term care insurance. what a family can do, because the government is really not providing a state or federal much support for home care. They are limited visits depending on if they were patient had been previously in a hospital. So in terms of preparation financially, it's like you need to review your insurance, see what is covered, how many in-home visits, are doctor visits covered. Very often what people find is that nurses can be actually more nurses consulting with physicians can be extremely helpful in handling it in most of the situations that people meet at home.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because of this, that our culture is not set up very well to handle home care in a terminal situation at this time. One of the things we're focusing on where I live in Kauai is share the care, which you may be familiar with.
I am indeed.
Right. Well, we just had Sheila Warnick, the founder and director of Share the Caring, to Kauai to give a presentation here, and she's coming back now in January to train 25 to 50 people on our island how to form caring teams, how to help families organize the resources and the people that they do have so that people can be cared for with as much comfort and love as possible at home. So I think this is going to be more and more prevalent. I would encourage people who are facing a dying at home to even go to Share the Care website. They have a book that can be ordered. Sheila and I have talked that between the two of our books, people could create very beautiful dyings at home. Because my book goes through what the family needs to do as caregivers, going step by step. And hers is how to organize family and friends to support the person at home.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to see more and more of this caring team. It's an idea whose time has come. It's about taking care of our own because there's no one else that's going to do that for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a profoundly nurturing and empowering experience.
Yes. Yes, it is. What should caregivers know about the legal aspects of caring for a loved one who's dying?
There are a number of areas. Obviously, they need to check on a will to see if the person has a will. They need to know the laws in your particular state, which you can call the coroner's office, or very often the social work office at a hospital, to find out exactly what the laws are in your state in terms of dying at home, attended or unattended deaths at home, burial. For example, in some states you can scatter ashes in certain places and other places you can't. These are things that you need to know ahead of time so that you can create an experience that's as comforting as possible for everyone involved and meets everyone's needs. What I would really recommend is something called Five Wishes. Five Wishes is it's actually a booklet. And it's put out by a group called Aging with Dignity out of Florida, and they have a website, agingwithdignity.org, and you can also fill out this document online. And what this it covers is you name the person you want to make care decisions for you when you can't, what kind of medical treatment you want or don't want, how comfortable you want to be, how you want people to treat you, what I want my loved ones to know. So it's a very, very complete document that's being recognized now nationally, and it makes very clear what the person's wishes are. For example, although I have a living will, I am now going to complete this Five Wishes online. What it does is it takes an enormous burden off of family members from making decisions for the person when they can no longer make those.
Mm-hmm.
Stated ahead of time, this is what I want, this is what I don't want. It's very comforting, one, to have expressed your wishes, and for the family actually have these wishes, that they following them to the best, to the best of their abilities.
Yeah. I just in reflection, my father had done that, and when he was no longer able to make decisions for himself, it made it very easy for us to know how to proceed, because it was all spelled out exactly what he wanted, and it was everyone was on the same page. So it just it really alleviated, family turmoil and stress.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very, very comforting for everybody involved. I mean, I highly recommend that people, think about this ahead of time. And also, just the fact of having to consider the, what your wishes are at that particular time in your life,
mm-hmm.
I think encourages us to live more fully in the present moment. We tend so often to just push away thoughts of death to, that happens to other people, and we don't often really deeply contemplate our own death. So what that does, it prevents us from living fully in the now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Can you suggest ways in which caregivers might handle guilt as well as grief?
Mm-hmm. Well, grieving, we know that as a hungry man needs to eat, and a sleepy person needs to sleep, a family who is dealing with grief needs to grieve. So the more fully we can allow ourselves to grieving, the more we prevent walking through the experience numb, but also having difficulty fully embracing our lives at the other end of this particular experience. Now, guilt, I always say guilt is just a total waste of time. But guilt is judging ourselves for things that we term as mistakes. And mistakes to me are really just opportunities to learn. So guilt is like looking backwards and playing, the Monday morning quarterback and say, well, I should have. And what I assume is that each moment people do the best that they can. Mm-hmm. If they later find that, wow, I could have done something much better, it's like forgive yourself and even congratulate yourself for increasing in wisdom. One of the things that can really help families with guilt is to at a family gathering, a family meeting about this, perhaps when you're considering making a decision, is this dying going to be at home? Does that work for all of us? That you're all going to do the best that you know, that we cannot know the outcome of every single medication or treatment or everything that we might do for with the dying person, and that as long as our intent is love, that's what we're responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, and therefore that there's no need for guilt. And for example, if somebody wanted to go out on lobster instead of carrot juice, and I was the one who gave the person the lobster that somehow put them over the process of absorbing that, put someone over the edge. What I did was with the intention was love, was to meet that person's request. Or so if we've decided earlier, ahead of time, we're doing our best, Then you can alleviate an enormous amount of guilt.
That's great. Okay. Well, in the last 6 minutes of the show, I was wondering, what do you hope readers will take away from your book, Coming Home?
What I would like for them to feel is to feel empowered, to know that they can handle a home dying. I want them to know that they're far more competent and loving than perhaps they even imagined. And I want them to know that the ultimate human freedom is freedom of attitude, that no matter what the circumstances of our lives, we can always choose our attitude, and our attitude determines the nature of our experience. So we can make of this experience potentially a surprisingly beautiful time in our lives, a time of comfort, a time of knowing that I gave the very best that I could, and this helps the grieving process later, and there aren't these sort of remnants of leftover, somewhat leftover sadness after someone we love has gone to the other side. I think that we have, in our culture, we have focused, we have such terrible images about death and dying. I mean, you look at the media and there's this, you know, these hideous deaths with war and starvation and hurricanes and tsunamis. And it's hard to hold a positive image of death, death and dying, when we're constantly barraged with these negative images. But the fact is that many people do have very beautiful deaths that uplift the people around them. But we don't talk about these because we don't like to talk about death and dying. Mm-hmm. Do we have a couple of minutes? I could tell you a quick story about my mother.
We've got about 4 minutes left, so real quick.
Okay, let's see if we can do it, because I hope your audience will find this meaningful. My mother had advanced Parkinson's and some dementia, and we went through a long saga of caring for her. At one point, we had arranged for her care. We had rented a house with her caregiver from where she previously been in a nursing home, and she was living there with the caregiver's three children, and we were sending the caregiver to nursing school so that after my mother died, she would have a better life for she and her children. So one day I got a call from little Deb saying that she thought my mother was closer to dying. So I asked, put my mother on the phone, and I said to Mom, well, what do you want me to do? And what she indicated was she wanted to see a doctor. And I thought, wow, how strange. My mother doesn't really like doctors. We don't have a doctor, actually, since she had left the nursing home, you know, several years earlier. But I reminded myself, this is her life, Deborah. You know, if your mother wants to see a doctor, then you arrange that. So we arranged for her to see a doctor the next day. That evening, little Deb said to Mom, you know, I was thinking she might die that night. You know, I could sleep in your room with you tonight. And Mother indicated, no, you know, go to your own room. And the next morning, little Deb was supposed to go to nursing school. And she said to Mom, you know, I could stay home with you this morning and take care of you. And Mom said, no, you go to school. So when little Deb got home, she picked my mother, who was now down to 90-some pounds, up in her arms and put her in the car, and they drove to the doctor's office. And little Deb helped her up on the examining table, and the doctor came in and took her pulse and said, you know, I can't find her pulse. She's not going to live very long. And little Deb sort of panicked and said, well, you know, do you think she's going to die on the way home in the car? And the doctor said, no, she'll make it home just fine. In the meantime, my mother is laying on one of those white-papered examining tables, grinning from ear to ear, looks at the doctor, gives him a great big smile, looks at little Deb, gives her a big smile, squeezes her hand, and she says, bye, and she dies.
Wow.
Yeah. So, Mom was an excellent organizer. She
to the end. Well, I have to, this was a great story, Deborah, and I just want to say thank you for being our guest today, and I know our audience is going to want to learn more about you, and they can at www.deborahduda.com. I'd like to thank our audience for tuning in today. Join us next time on Tuesday, October 25th at 2 p.m. Eastern for our online radio show, Caregiver and Physician Conversations, hosted by eCare Diaries caregiving expert Marjorie. Marjorie will interview Dr. Dennis McCullough, family physician and geriatrician, and author of My Mother, Your Mother. This helps caregivers and seniors connect with doctors and care providers to navigate a medical crisis. To learn more about eCare Diary and our upcoming shows, visit www.ecarediary.com. Registration is free and gives you immediate access to your personal care diary tool. You can find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. My Twitter address is ecare_diary. Thank you again. Bye now.
Okay, you there?